Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Today we're going to hear a variety of stories about organized sports and kids. We're starting with a discussion of Ultimate Frisbee, a sport that for some reason we've never covered before in the show. If you thought it was a disorganized hippie activity, you have much to learn. We're going to hear about Serious Ultimate and the group in town that's trying to start a youth league. Parents, listen up. Later, we'll hear about a biking program for girls to gain confidence in the critical middle school year. That's all ahead on Outdoor Explorer from Alaska Public Media. I have two guests in the studio right now to talk about a really, really fun game, which is also a sport, and it also has an international presence, but it also has some really unique qualities. And I was amazed that we've never talked about Ultimate Frisbee on the show in our 5 years. And I was speculating that maybe the reason for that is I think of it as like a not super organized thing, and where would I find the people to talk to? But my two guests are definitely organized, and they're trying to build the sport and bring more youth into it. And so we're going to talk about Ultimate Frisbee, the joy of this sport, and what's happening, how you could get involved, and what it's all about. So thanks for being here, Anne Ohms.
Mm-hmm. Hello.
Thanks for coming in. And John Gregoire, thanks for being here.
Hello.
The group is called Anchorage Ultimate. So who wants to start by simply explaining what this sport is? So it's like when you watch it, there's people like sort of taking steps, throwing Frisbees. What are they doing?
So you can definitely pass a Frisbee back and forth. And that is just playing catch. And then when you put it on a field, it becomes Ultimate Frisbee. And it's 7-on-7. It's a certain size field that's similar to a skinny football field. And so you play passing it back and forth all the way down the field and try and score in an end zone.
Which means that somebody catches it when they're standing in there like a football in a
mm-hmm,
sense.
Yeah. In that sense, yep, their feet in the end zone. You can't run with the Frisbee. It's a non-contact sport. You can't run into each other or pull Frisbee out of people's hands. But generally, that's the basics of the sport. You can get more and more technical.
Uh-huh.
But that's the basics of the sport.
Yeah. And so it's really simple to learn. I mean, it's not a million rules.
Not in the basic level, no.
Uh-huh. Okay. And in terms of, like, if you're playing soccer, you are need to be fit.
True.
It seems like an ultimate, you could be a little bit more relaxed. I'm sure professionals are super fit, but maybe you don't have to be like super super hard body to do this sport.
I think that's true if you want to join our summer league and have some fun. At the same time, at the highest level of competition, I think you may have to be more fit than you would for soccer.
Uh-huh.
It's extremely fast. It's constant sprinting. It's a tournament sport primarily, so you're playing multiple games over a weekend when you're participating at the highest level. So if you're going for, say, the national championship, you're going to play 9 games over a weekend, and you're going to be sprinting as fast as you possibly can all day long in 100-yard bursts. So,
So I'm getting the sense that this is not what the image of the pot-smoking, beer-swilling college students. It's a little bit different.
I think it began in high school and then has really taken root in colleges mostly. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it's been seen as an alternative sport.
Sure. It's like if you don't want to be on a team where a coach is going to be yelling at you all the time, mm-hmm. you go out and do this and have fun.
Yeah. And I think that there's good and bad things about that. One of the things that this sport is really built on is called the spirit of the game. And it's really the heart of the sport. And the actual wording is that it places the responsibility for fair play on the player. And you want highly competitive play, except never at the expense of mutual respect and the joy of the game. And so it ends up feeling like some hippy-dippy pie in the sky. Mm-hmm. We come together and sing kumbaya and love each other.
What's wrong with that?
But really, in the end, at this highest level of competition, you're really asking players, how do you handle yourself under pressure? And in a moment of intense conflict or a foul, you take a step back and you breathe, and then you talk to that other player mm-hmm. that fouled you. And it's very different than other sports. And so it gets the feel of that community, like no rules sort of thing. But really what it is this deep sense of respect and love of mm-hmm. the sport and respect for yourself. And yeah. that's very important.
Well, and I want to get into that some more, but I mean, in terms of like where the sport came from, is that developing a little bit from the fact that it was a little bit of an outsider thing and just guys getting and women getting together having fun, and so you have to call your own fouls.
Yeah, and on top of that, not only did it start that way, but the rules evolved that way with players saying, hey, this should be a rule and presenting it, and then it became adopted. And so in the early years of the sport, which, you know, I came into maybe the second generation of the sport, and what are we in the fifth or sixth generation of player now? You know, the rules seem to change every year. Pretty substantially. They're more hard and fast now. They don't change as much as they did.
Because people just had it, oh, it would be more fun this way.
Yeah, or this is safer, or this is more equitable. But something that I would point out that's a bit of a diversion, then go back to your answer, that I think is really neat. In other sports, say soccer, and I'll pick on basketball, as a player, you learn to play the game. You also learn to play the refs. Mm-hmm. You learn how to flop. How to look like you got fouled to get those shots. In ultimate, you have to learn the rules. Mm-hmm. And then you have to learn to be a human being. Like, you truly have to learn how to judge yourself and say, did I just get beat here and I'm having a hard time being a good sport, so I'm going to call a foul? Or did I really get fouled? Mm-hmm. And then you have to have a conversation with the person you're letting know, hey, you did this to me. And then they can say, no, I didn't do that to you. And it's quick. It all happens in moments. You have to know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But because of that, there's a whole nother layer of sportsmanship and celebration of athleticism and respect for other people that just doesn't exist in other sports. I've never felt it anywhere else.
Cool. Oh.
You can Google Ultimate Frisbee Integrity Rule and see at the highest televised levels players overturning calls by the officials in favor of their opponent because they know that the official called it wrong. And that is unheard of as well.
Yeah, very much so. So in terms of like when you're talking about these fouls that people will call on themselves, it would be contact, like you accidentally touched somebody?
Yep.
Is it any touching or is it like...
It's touching that affects that player's ability to make a fair play on the disc. And so you've contacted them in a way that has impeded their fair play on the disc. And so it doesn't have to be intentional. It doesn't have to be egregious. It just has to have affected the fair play.
Mm-hmm. So as I'm trying to visualize this, like I've got the Frisbee and I can't move my feet. I'm planted.
You can pivot.
I can pivot, right. Mm-hmm. You got to keep one foot planted. Mm-hmm. And then I'm looking for one of my teammates to throw the Frisbee to down the field. Mm-hmm. And the other players are trying to intercept that.
Yes.
And so I'm sure there's a ton of strategy there, but I can see a lot of opportunities for people to bump into each other and be fighting for that Frisbee.
Mm-hmm. And there's incidental contact. There's definitely, I mean, it's but it is within the realm of respect and fair play. And I think that's part of why Ultimate as a mixed gender sport has been so successful. It's maybe one of the only sports where it's truly equitable on the field with mixed gender men and women because there isn't tackling, there isn't some of that physicality that makes it difficult for men and women to play together. Mm-hmm. You really rely on your legs to get open and not shoving off somebody.
And maybe not, I mean, basketball, there's the height issue. So women could be just as good a basketball player, but if somebody's 2 feet taller, it's hard to compete. But in ultimate, maybe that's not such a big issue.
Well, as a short guy, I would tell you it is not so easy. In fact, you know, height often dictates role that you play on the field, and it's really hard for a short person to be a deep cutter, for example, to be the one that runs to score. Mm-hmm. Often those are your tall, lanky.
Right, who somebody can leap way high and grab it out of the air. Right,
people that got out of basketball.
But it seems like the skill in throwing a Frisbee would be like the critical skill here, because it's. I mean, I love playing Frisbee, and figuring out how to make that accurate throw is a huge skill. I mean, half the time when you're out playing Frisbee, you're actually just trying to do stunts and throw it ways, right? So you don't have to worry about that.
Uh-huh.
But is that a fact?
I think that's one of the things I've been talking a lot with kids as I run youth things is it does give you the impression that you have to throw a Frisbee well in order to play Ultimate. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely where you want to go. But in the beginning, you can run and catch and throw a very short 2-foot pass and run away again and be a very valuable player. Hmm. And so often I'll tell kids that running is the first step and using your feet is the first step, and we'll teach you how to throw, we'll teach you how to catch. But if you like to run, you're going to love this sport, because you don't get to play just offense or just defense or just this zone or that zone. Everybody's got the whole field the whole time. And so I think throwing, while definitely important, you do start to specialize. You become a handler, a cutter, but start with
your
legs.
So what are these different, cutter is like the forward, is trying to make a goal?
So a handler would be they're your throwers. Now, on a high-level team, everyone throws. Everyone can throw, but your handlers are the people that are managing field.
Kind of like a guard
presence.
In basketball.
Or a quarterback.
Yep, yeah. Or a quarterback.
Okay.
But
but the play is continuous. It's not like football where everybody stops, right? It's like basketball
constant.
Or soccer. Yeah.
But when you're trying to reset, sort of like a guard in basketball, you get it back to a handler.
Got
and then they set up the play, or they're, you know, they're keeping the pace. And then the cutters are moving at the short place or in that midfield area, and they're getting you yardage. You know, you're getting it to them, they're getting it back to a handler, or so on and so forth. They're setting up the continuation plays and the scores. And then you have deeps or deep cutters that are, you know, they're just going wild to score. They're fast, they're furious, they're unstoppable, and they're really fun to watch. That's where all the highlights tend to come from.
And when we talked about this, both genders are on the field. Is there a rule about that? You have to have so many men and so many women on the field at one time?
Yeah, they've just recently changed it now at the highest level at the World Games, where the gender ratio has generally been 4 men and 3 women. And it's just changed now to where they do 4 men, 3 women, and then they'll switch to 4 women and 3 men to keep it much more equitable. And it's an ongoing discussion in the Ultimate community, how we continue to build gender equity within the sport. Because there's also single gender divisions, which are a lot of fun. But it's kind of everything together.
But if you're playing just like down in the park strip or something, it's good. It's all mixed. Everybody's just there and you try to keep it equal. Basically.
In our summer league, we play with 4 men and 3 women on the field at all times.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there will be great athletes who will say, I don't care if you don't match up. A woman on me, I'm going to play because there aren't enough. One of the things we struggle with that we're constantly trying to do is get more female athletes to the sport, which is part of the reason why we're really trying to grow from the youth level up, is that the sooner you get a Frisbee in your hand and start playing, the more fun you're going to have and the better you're going to be.
Well, let's get into that in the next segment here about how people can get involved and learn to play and get their kids involved. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about Ultimate Frisbee today, and Ann Ohms and John Gregoire are from Anchorage Ultimate, and have a lot of connections to the sport and have played it for a long time. So you're trying to build the game here in Anchorage, and I guess probably a lot of people just show up in town, they played it in college, where's the Ultimate game, get online, find you, done, right? But you're trying to sort of make it a little bit more organic from the bottom up, and you're just alluding to that. So what's the challenge there? I guess we don't have it in schools.
I want to share a little thing about our own Frisbee community, and then talk a little bit about the challenges to growing the sport. But what you described is correct. Alaska Ultimate started because some folks in the mid-90s came here and had played in the lower 48 at college. And so they brought Ultimate. And so I think it was 1997, the first tournament was held in the APU field over here. And then it just grew from there. So we've been having tournaments every year since 1997.
Been
hosting teams from the lower 48. And so our community is full of some of the most amazing players that have moved up here for the love of Alaska and the love of the outdoors, who are really accomplished players. And then we have a whole new generation of folks that grew up playing. They came out to our adult league. We adopted them early, you know, 14, 15 even, started playing with us, and they've played their whole lives. Some of them went to college and played and won nationals and all that stuff. So we've got a good, robust history. And so we're able to get that teenage to college age to adult age pretty easily. But getting into elementary and middle school is something that we've struggled with.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of just developing and bringing kids up into the sport.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think part of that, it's tricky with our climate. It's hard to get outside on the green fields very quickly.
Yeah.
In many other
communities. Yeah, in terms of school, yeah. I mean, yeah. The poor soccer and football players, get their season is like very, very short.
I started in high school, and we just go out after school and play, and that's just kind of hard to do here. I was working with Wilwa Elementary this year, and we had hoped to get outside anytime, and then the weather never quite worked for that. But I think part of it, too, is that this is such... It's an inexpensive sport. You need a frisbee, preferably one created by Discraft.
Why is that?
It's a good feel. It's the right... the right shape, the right aerodynamics.
Interesting. I didn't know there was a special frisbee. I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, it's like the free bank frisbees don't fly very well and can be really aggravating in the end because you don't actually have the right weight to get good spin on
it. Yeah, so you need a real frisbee.
Real frisbee really
But it's different
helps.
From like a frisbee golf disc.
It is. It's bigger and soft and, bigger.
Mm-hmm.
but I think, so for youth, it's... Part of those things we talked about earlier with the integrity of it, where you're really teaching youth to own their sportsmanship and to own themselves as a player, I think is an incredible life skill, and it's something that I hope my daughters learn. And so I would love for them to play Frisbee because it really teaches them to advocate for themselves and to own their own integrity and also to be competitive at the same time. And so I think getting this into schools, gym teachers around the city are teaching this to their students. We would love to partner with them. We're finding new ways to partner with gym teachers. But finding ways from kids who already have skiing and basketball and these mainstream
things. Or they're out fishing or doing whatever they do in the summertime. The town kind of empties out a little bit.
Yeah, and so we have some of those barriers there. But seeing kids' faces light up when they finally get that backhand snap or throw a forehand for the first time, it's pretty amazing to watch kids know that they can throw a frisbee. It's kind of a unique skill.
Yeah, so. Cool. So in terms of your events that you're doing in your games, it sounds like, you know, that you're on a team and you're practicing and all that. Is there an opportunity for people just to sort of show up, hey, I want to do this, and just find, you know, do a pickup game?
There is. So I want to focus first on youth and just to explain what we're doing so that any parents that are listening know, hey,
absolutely,
I want to get my kid involved. One is that we've got an organized league. All of our coaches have gone through a certification process through the National Ultimate Association. So it's a safe sport certification. So we've done courses that prepare us to make sure that we are safe and supportive and educational with children.
Okay, cool.
We have coordinated the way that we're going to teach the process and the way that we're going to coach teams, and we're going to organize by skill and age.
So this is all kind of new, right?
This will be the first
building it from
league.
The ground up.
Yeah.
Inaugural year.
Okay, cool.
Inaugural year. So and maybe you could share a little in the number of weeks and how the first week you could
so
just
you
show
sign
up.
Sign up. Do you need to pay a fee? Like an entry fee because you've got expenses?
Yes, we currently, for our youth league, which will meet on Tuesdays in the month of June and July, the first night actually is free. It is pickup. Any family can come and we'll teach everyone who shows up how to play. That night is June 12th at 6 p.m. on the Park Strip. And then there will be five more weeks, and that is $30. But each child will leave with a Frisbee. And also we're going to have dinner every night as well. So $30
that's
for 5 weeks
bargain.
Of dinner and a Frisbee. And but that first night is free for anybody to come check it out.
Uh-huh.
Our website is anchorageultimate.org, and there's a link to youth up at the top there, and you can register through that website.
And we'll have that on our site at outdoorexplorer.org. If people don't remember it, you can always find whatever links you hear on the show at outdoorexplorer.org.
Thank you.
And
cool.
Every team will have a certified head coach and then a group of assistant coaches. So kids will really get some support to learn techniques and very important to both of us. And we're both parents who are teaching our kids to play as well, is that kids don't get lost because they can't throw or don't feel like they don't have a purpose because maybe they can't run as fast.
So kids who have no experience, know nothing, are welcome. And what ages are you aiming for?
We're aiming for elementary to middle school. We will definitely stratify by age depending what we get.
You don't know how many kids are going to show up. Yeah.
We don't yet. but I guess starting around third grade is a really great age to start. You can teach younger, but once you start playing with bigger kids as they grow, it's nice to make third graders also feel welcome.
Yeah, of course.
So we're kind of aiming fully that late elementary all the way up through eighth grade, kids who have just graduated from eighth grade.
So just to clarify, do they need to register on the site before they come or just show up?
They are, it would be great if they did.
Yeah.
We could plan better, including how much food to have. And
that's the way to
go. And again, every kid gets a Frisbee so that we can have all that stuff ready to go. So if you know you're going to do it, you could register. Even if you decided, hey, we're out of town three of these nights, but we can do the other ones. Great. If you register.
Well, it's only
$30,
bucks, right?
Yeah, I mean, right. It's $30 and you get a Frisbee, which would cost you $15. So.
Right. It's good for you guys. That's really neat that you're doing all this. So I also wanted to get into like the adult who wants to try it and maybe did it in college, or maybe they just think, I like playing with Frisbee. Maybe this would be fun. How does that person get involved without sort of joining a team or whatever?
Sure. there is pickup then on the park strip on Sunday afternoons at 3 p.m. and also Thursday nights at 6 p.m. And so that is also on our website.
So it's like just show up and there'll be people there. They'll probably teach you the rules if you want to know because it's a fun thing.
It is. And I think this is really everybody who plays the sport that I've met has such a heart for this sport. And it is still a very young sport in the realm of sport in our country. And so we do want to teach. Many of us are really, really looking to bring people under our wing and show them the ropes. And there are many, many people who have just been playing 2 or 3 years who have just gotten excited about it. And they it's a really good mood at the pickup games. It is definitely, it's competitive. So if you're athletic and you're looking for athleticism, it's there. But if you really just want to come check it out, it's a great place to come and throw around on the sideline and pop in the game whenever you're ready.
Sounds fun, yeah.
And
so, yeah, go ahead,
I just want to jump in and say that there are games happening all over the place. I mean, you drive by the park strip, you'll see people out there playing. I live next to Balto Sapala Park. There's always a group that's there. There are many groups, church groups, youth groups that are playing that aren't associated with our groups. There's many options. Our group is true to the nature of the sport and the rules. And so, like Anne mentioned, it is competitive. We do care. We do have strategy. We do try to play a certain way. And we really want to teach people, you know, the sport.
Right.
And so I just want to share with folks, it can be intimidating or you can feel like, oh gosh, I'll never, but you will.
Yeah.
If you just keep coming and you know that no one's judging you because you, you know, sometimes people get hot-headed. Those folks we talk to as well and say, hey, don't be so hot-headed.
Yeah.
But be aware that we want to teach you the sport as it actually is, and we want you to enjoy it as it actually is, and we want you to be able to be a competitor to the best of your ability and have fun at the same time. So don't be intimidated that folks might take it too seriously.
Right.
Remember that some of those folks played on the best teams in the world.
Well, I wanted to get into that, and I know some of your family members have gone a long way with this. So tell me about that.
My family, almost all of us play. My younger sister, Georgia, has played since she was maybe 14 and has 5 gold world medals and 2 silvers and some national championships, and was awarded our equivalent of the Heisman Trophy back when she was in college.
Wow.
It's called the Callahan Award. And so she has played all over and is an amazing ambassador for the sport. She has amazing spirit and is incredibly friendly. And my brother and then my brother-in-law, her husband, both play professionally in Madison, Wisconsin for the Madison Radicals. And they play in front of large crowds and they are televised.
I didn't know there was a professional.
There is a professional league called the AUDL. And they have teams all over the country. This is a growing thing. There are now also, I believe, 7 or 9 women who are also in the league. It's an open gendered league. And so it's growing and they're getting a fan base. But my kids have Radicals shirts and we cheer
cool.
for them when we watch them on TV.
That's so amazing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you kind of didn't have any choice. This had to be your sport.
We started with a Frisbee dog, a dog who caught Frisbees, and we've gone from there. My mom just retired from her team called the Slip Discs, now at 65. So it's definitely a family sport for us. And my two daughters, 5 and 3, are learning to throw, starting to learn to catch.
Very so. Good. Mm-hmm. Very good. And John, how did you get into this? Did you pick it up in school?
No, I actually had a friend who came to visit me, and I was living in Seattle and feeling kind of melancholy, and he said, I need to get you out of here.
As people in Seattle do.
Right. Right. You know, I understood why Nirvana happened.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so he grabbed me and said, we're going to go, and on the way to this tournament in Western Washington or Eastern Washington, we stopped at a store and picked up a pair of cleats, and I was on a team that ended up making it to the semifinals, and I had no idea what I was doing.
Oh, cool.
But I was absolutely hooked, and what hooked me was the camaraderie, the sportsmanship, the general fun and silliness.
And you don't have to be like learn to do it when you're 2 years old, right. And you have to do it 100% of the time or you're no good. Yeah,
no.
You get to just jump in.
And the learning curve was really quick. So for that first year, I mean, I played defense. That's it. And I yelled a lot on the sideline, and I wrote some of the best cheers that people had heard, and I had a lot of fun. And then I practiced, just like you would with any sport, you know, 100 throws a day. And
get better,
Yep, and you just work, and you fall in love with it, and then you really learn the rules, and it goes from there.
And all you need is a disc and a proper pair of shoes.
And a few friends,
And another entryway, which we haven't talked about, is our adult league, which meets on Monday nights at the Park Strip, which will go all the way from June 4 to August 13 at 6 p.m. And that is also on our website. But we're really seeking to make those first couple nights of that league really inclusive and even require some handicapping of the players who have played a long time in order that those who are coming for the first time can really kind of get rolling
have
with
some
the sport.
Fun. Yeah.
Right. And before we kind of take that off and just go with it. But really seeking to grow the sport.
Cool.
And it's been an incredible, around the world, an incredible sport. There's something also called Ultimate Peace, which is an ultimate Frisbee camp, bringing together Israeli and Palestinian kids and getting them to play together. And just kind of the different ways that the sport is really bringing people together is something that we want to bring here in Anchorage as
neat,
well.
Neat. Well, thanks so much for coming to tell me about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really,
yeah.
really
Thank
interesting.
Thank you for having us.
Ann Ohms and John Gregoire are with the Anchorage Ultimate. You can find their site through ours at outdoorexplorer.org and all the events they're talking about. So thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Great. And good luck with your summer.
Thank you very much.
And on the way out, if I could just say,
sure.
we also have a Facebook group and more activity occurs in Facebook. So more updates and random pickup and people putting teams together to go out of state. We'll make announcements. And so if
we'll put up that link too.
Absolutely. Join that group if you want to follow and you want to get involved. And one other thing about the adult league is that it's a family friendly league. So
That's
if
true.
You have your kids playing in the kids league and you yourself want to play in the adult league, you could bring them with you to that night and they could play with the other kids that are there. And we encourage the whole family. Many of us bring our children up in this community.
Yes.
So
awesome. Great. Yeah. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Outdoor Explorer continues. Stay with us.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
I'm Charles Wolfart. This is Outdoor Explorer. Our next piece comes from our regular Trail Tales feature, which producer Eric Bork records at the 49th State Brewery in downtown Anchorage. Alaska Trails hosts the event. We're going to hear a story by Caitlin Rodriguez, who helped lead a biking program called Grit for middle school girls.
Oh man, thanks for having me. My name's Caitlin Rodriguez, and if you don't know me, maybe you've heard about a program I started called Anchorage Grit with my dear friend Leo Wilcox. And if you haven't heard about it, real briefly, Anchorage Grit is an after-school program where we take seventh grade girls from the Anchorage School District and we explore and learn a lot about our beautiful city all from the saddle on bicycle. So when you guys asked me to tell a story this evening about Anchorage Grit, my immediate thoughts went to all the girls' accomplishments and all the hardships that they endured and their smiles, and I quickly realized, like, those are their stories to tell, those aren't mine. So what I can tell you about is what I learned when I got to spend a few months with this amazing group of young women. So it all started last winter when I was biking some trails down in the Baja Peninsula with my friend Leo Wilcox, and some weather had rolled in, and so we were staying at this cheap motel drinking coffee, and I had wearily mentioned, like, oh, I'm just so grateful for all the things I've learned from bike touring and how independent it's made me, and how I really wish I had learned these things at a younger age. And with those words, Grit was born, and we spent the rest of our time biking together, scheming up how we were going to get bikes, all the people we were going to include in our program, what we were going to do. So Anchorage Grit really taught me how to start a business. So during the second week of the program, we went to pick the girls up at their school as we normally did. And they're getting ready, and I come in, and one of the girls comes over to me, and she's like, Kate, the bikes are gone. And I was like, well, okay, hold your horses. The bikes aren't gone. This is not a big deal. But no, it had turned out someone had broken in and stolen the bicycles from the program. So we're trying to move on with our day, and I'm trying to show them that, you know, these types of things don't deter us from achieving our goals. And they even were joking that we were now GWIT instead of GRIT, girls walking into tomorrow, because we walked to our activity. They did a great job, but in the security of my home, I really mourned. I didn't know how I was going to keep the program going. I couldn't understand how someone would steal from a program like this, and the anxiety kept me up all night. But as I'm watching my phone, it keeps lighting up with all these donations coming in, and by the time I woke up the next morning, we were fully funded to replace the bikes and keep our program going. So Grit taught me, yeah, you guys did awesome. So Grit taught me the power of community. It would be an exaggeration to say that our girls were cycling prodigies. They were amazing, but we had to learn how to brake without the use of dragging our feet, however effective that may seem. We had to learn that our shifters weren't these untouchable levers that are going to make your bicycle sound like it's going to implode. We spent a whole day working on mountain bike skills, charging hills, descending steep drops, how to roll over logs. It was an amazing day. The girls learned so much. And as we're coming back from it, the girls find this really steep hill in Russian Jack Park, and they start going up it, seeing who can get the highest. And I immediately am like, oh God, I know my girls. They're gonna fall. You have a fall every day. There's gonna be tears. I really don't want tears after a day like this. But their cheers were so encouraging, and it brought me in. And so now all of a sudden, I'm cheering from the sideline, and I'm taking a turn, and I'm charging the hill. And we just accomplished so much. They were so overjoyed that day, and I was overjoyed. And we're like crying and laughing and sweating. And so Grit taught me the power of what you can accomplish when you have a support team. In preparation for our final trip, we biked out to Pizza Man in Anchorage, and as we get on the trail, I realized all my expectations for the day were gone. I really wanted the girls to bike together in unity and talk to each other and build this group cohesion and really get to know each other, but they were spread out all over the trail. I'm never biking the same speed, and it turns out one girl is a prodigy and she can bike really fast. And instead of asking her to hang back with the rest of the group, I just kind of give her some distance and occasionally ask her if she wants a snack or some water and let her set her own expectation and her own speed. And she did amazing, and when we get back, I'm like, oh man, did you have a really good time? Are you really proud of yourself? And she just kind of sheepishly looks up at me and grins. And so grit taught me how to be supportive rather than selfish. During our first day of our capstone trip, we biked to the Beach Lake Cabin Compound, which is out in Chugach, and it was the longest ride the girls had done to date. They did an amazing job. They taught me all their sing-along songs. In case you were wondering, they still go on and on forever just because. When we got to the cabins, we went out to the inlet, we skipped rocks, we picked berries, we made popcorn, we had a popcorn fight. We chatted shamelessly way too late into the evening, even though we had to get up early. So grit rejuvenated my joy in a slumber party. And then the final thing the girls accomplished was biking from the Beach Lake cabin compound out to the Serenity Falls cabin at the end of Eklutna Lake. They climbed 1,800 feet, and that's where all the car support ended. So we loaded up a trailer with all the food and all the camp gear, and I carried the trailer out. And I finally realized how well these girls were doing, because the fatigue is setting deep into my legs. And I am just like, oh man, I'm at the back of the pack, which I was not expecting. But we queued up a motivation mix. I took some song requests. We finally make it out to the cabin. We're playing cards together. We had some amazing trail angels that left snacks for us out at the cabin, which was really fun. We built a campfire and made some s'mores. And it's just been a long day. And because we're old and the mentors are all old, we're getting tired. Just as the sun's going down, we're getting tired, and the girls are still really jazzed. And I'm falling asleep on my bunk, and I can hear girls down by the river laughing, playing, enjoying, doing those things that you only can do when there's no cell phones and you're really connecting with nature. But for me, my fear just sets in again. I'm like, oh God, youth, running water, this is gonna be horrible. Like, what, I gotta stay up. And finally, I'm like, no, I have to let this go. Just relax. We've taught them everything we know. We've accomplished everything that Lael and I had talked about back on that dusty trail in Baja. And so finally, grit taught me that sometimes you can just relax and enjoy your accomplishments. Thank you.
That was Caitlin Rodriguez speaking at Trail Tales, the event put on by Alaska Trails. You can learn more about them and the event through our site at outdoorexplorer.org. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth, and there's an event coming up, which is a pretty unique one. It's a sprint triathlon that is run in the Matanuska Valley, and it's all outdoor trail event. But what's really special about it is it's a benefit for kids who really need it, families who really need it. It's called the Little A Triathlon. It was founded by J.T. Lindholm in honor of his daughter, who passed away at a very young age. And each year it's benefited another kid. And just a wonderful thing that you're doing, JT.
I really think it's neat.
So I guess I've done that intro, but let's hold off on that. And let's just talk about the race. It's coming up June 30th. And it's takes place out at what we used to call Kepler Lakes. I don't know what you call it now.
Absolutely, yeah. So the trailhead is Matanuska Lakes State Recreation Area.
Okay.
I think most old-timers know it as Kepler Bradley.
Yeah, it's right after you do the Y between the Glen Highway and the Parks Highway, and you're headed up to Palmer.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. So the swim is about a half mile. Our swim director would tell you it's exactly a half mile in Matanuska Lake, followed up by about an 11-mile mountain bike ride.
So and on dirt trail.
On dirt
Which makes it unique. Yeah.
Yeah. Combination of single track and double track and dirt roads. But certainly all the technical bits on the mountain bike section you could easily walk or push. Mm-hmm. And many people will tell you that they do. And then lastly, it ends with about a 4-mile trail run.
And then do you end up at the starting point or?
So the transition area, start and finish are all right there at that parking area.
So you don't have to like set up your transition in multiple different spots.
Correct. Yep. Okay. The transition area is right there.
It simplifies it, right?
It simplifies it for the racers and the directors.
Yeah. So, and how many entrants do you have a limit, right?
We're limited by state parks to 100. And in the past 2 years that we've done this, it has filled up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Entry fee?
Entry fee. This year we're trying a sliding scale to try to encourage people to sign up earlier. So it's currently set at $100 for an individual and $150 for a team. And then on June 1st, it'll go up a little bit more than that.
Okay. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about how you had this idea and
sure.
your daughter and what happened. So where did this idea come from?
Yeah. So in 2015, my daughter was diagnosed with a form of brain cancer called medulloblastoma. And after about a 5.5-month battle, she ended up passing away about 10 days shy of her third birthday.
Yeah, just an adorable little girl.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I could talk all afternoon about
her.
soon after that, in just trying to struggle, in my struggle to sort of make sense of things, I signed up for an event raising money for a girl out in Eagle River named Maddie Brandel, to raise money for her cancer treatment.
Because it can destroy a family financially to have this happen, right?
Absolutely. Even with insurance, I mean, it's incredible.
The travel and missed work and everything else.
Yeah, yeah, all that. All the associations with travel, from airlines to hotel stays. Mm-hmm. Yeah. On top of the medical bills. And so attended Maddie's run, the first round of Maddie's run, and got done with that and actually had the opportunity to meet Maddie and her family and walked away from that thinking, here's this opportunity to take my grief and potentially do something positive with it. Mm-hmm. And so I just sort of rallied the troops. I rallied my support network, and said, hey, I'd like to do something in honor of my daughter. My daughter's name is Avery, and my wife's name is Adrian, and so my wife was always known as Big A, and my daughter was known as Little A. And after getting together a couple times with, these friends, my support group, we decided on creating a triathlon in her memory that would raise funds for a family in need. It just coincidentally turned out that the family needing it the most was Maddie Brandel and her family. So our very first year, we raised over $12,000.
Wow.
For the Brandels. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, thanks.
And then the next year, another kid?
And the next year, yep. So every year we've been kind of changing the family, mm-hmm. and changing the kid. We're not, if we need to do a repeat person some year, we're not gonna rule that out. It's not, we don't have that in our mission statement or anything. But we have been trying to sort of spread the funds.
So who's the beneficiary for this coming race?
Yeah, so this year it's Jazzy Holloway, who's a fourth grader. And she now is actually living in Washington for treatment because she's unable to get her treatment up here. So her plan and her family's plan is to move back to Alaska, mm-hmm. as soon as they get done with treatment.
Well, so that'll be a really nice thing for people to know that they're actually running and their $100 is going for a really, really good cause.
Every bit of effort put into this is done by volunteers. There's no money being made by anyone. So you can see that your money is going to go directly to the family in need. And it's been a real special thing to be a part of. My most favorite part of the event is the post-race event. Mm-hmm. Just being able to sit there and celebrate with the volunteers and with the other racers. We've had a band, and we'll have a band this year as well. And we have root beer donated, and everybody gets a metal cup when they finish. So lots of food and drinks, and just it's just a really incredible outpouring of support for, nice. For the community.
Nice. Yeah. Well, you can, if you want to sign up, we're pre-recording, so we don't know if there's spots still available. If you are, you can find out about it on the race website, which will be posted at our site at outdoorexplorer.org. So, and the race director is JT Lindholm. Thanks for being here, JT.
I appreciate it, Charles. Thank you.
All right. Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and it is time once again for our training calendar. We're sitting down once a month with Lisa Keller of Multisport Training of Alaska to help listeners stay on track for your goals for endurance events. We were going to talk about the Run Fest, which used to be called the Big Wildlife Run. Mm-hmm. It's a multi-distance run, and maybe the biggest one in Anchorage, huge numbers, mm-hmm. in August.
Yep.
So you've got about 2.5 months before that.
Right. It's kind of the culmination of the running season, really, because then it starts to get cold after that. So
yeah. So I guess you would be preparing differently for the different distances, from all the way from like 49K all the way down to 5K.
Right.
So just let's maybe start. Probably the biggest is half marathon or marathon. Mm-hmm. Let's start mm-hmm. with those and sort of where you want to be 10 weeks out.
Well, you're looking at being at your longest runs, but maybe you haven't started to really put lots of race pace in there yet. So you're just adapting your body to the aerobic demands of being out there for a long period of time. So you're kind of strengthening your bones and your muscles and everything to the demands of running on the road, which can have a lot of impact on your body. So you want to make sure that you can be at about the amount of time you're going to be running the race.
So if you're going to be in a road race, run on pavement. Don't run on the edge, run on the actual trail.
Yeah. Right. And that gets kind of tricky because, we love Anchorage people, Alaska people love to run on trails. And I think there's definitely, especially for older runners, it's really helpful to be able to mix that up. So mm-hmm. I don't see anything wrong with having a trail run or two a week in your training program. But you definitely have to make sure your body is adapted to running on asphalt and trails.
Okay.
Or hard trails.
So you're 10 weeks out and you're planning to do the marathon, mm-hmm. then you're doing like 16-mile runs at this point or 20-mile runs?
So I'm big on going on time rather than distance. So if you've already set a race goal in your mind, and for the marathon, maybe your race goal is 4 hours. There's kind of a school of thought that there's not much more you can do after running for about 3 hours on your long runs, and it actually takes too much out of you to do that mm-hmm. repeatedly. And so a lot of times we leave the long run at 3 hours. It kind of depends, again, on how long it's going to take you to do the race. So I might push it to 3.5 hours for those people who are running between 3 and 4 hours. If you're running a 2:30 marathon, you don't have to go up to 3 hours.
Right. Of course, if you're running a 2:30 marathon, you probably don't need our advice.
Yeah, that's right. You already know what you're doing.
Let's touch on the marathon versus the half marathon. Mm-hmm. A half marathon is like a much... More than half as much decrease in effort. I mean, it's really a totally different race.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there really is something about, around mile 20 of most marathons, people kind of, the wheels kind of fall off. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily happen in a half marathon. I mean, obviously, you're going half the distance. And when we talk about the 49K, that's different, too, because you're going so much slower over such a long distance that you don't have that same bonk that you have in the marathon, which is, I mean, it is really something. Unless you've done a marathon, you don't know what that feels like. It's really
nightmare.
Weird.
It feels horrible.
It feels terrible. And every 50K that I've ever done, I've never had that problem. And of course, I've never had it in a half marathon either, because it's short enough. Now, the demands of the half marathon are different because you're running a lot faster mm-hmm. over a sustained period of time. So it's that kind of balance of how fast can I run over, maybe 2 hours without, just dying at the end either. But it's just a different feeling.
Is it the same deal you were mentioning before where you would say, how fast do I expect to do this race, and mm-hmm. then run that amount of time?
Correct. Yeah. Okay. So your longest run doesn't have to be longer than you think you're going to mm-hmm. run it in time. And I, like I said, I don't like looking at miles. I like looking mm-hmm. at time and not worrying about the miles. Later on, you can put that race pace
time in there as well, so you'll pick up some more miles doing that.
But then if you're doing the ultra, then mm-hmm. you're just three and a half at the max and call it good.
Well, I might go longer on the ultra. Yeah, I definitely, even though there's that theory that you don't get much after 3 hours, I mean, I think when you're going that far, you really do have to adjust your body to being out on your feet for that amount of time. This is different because it's an ultra on hard trails, on asphalt trails, as opposed to on trails that are soft.
Right.
I mean, that's much more enjoyable, I think, than just pounding your legs up. So you can go longer and include hiking in it. That's what I would do for the 49K.
Okay. So we've talked a little bit about different ways of preparing, but we haven't really talked about sleeping and how that plays into your performance.
Sleep is huge, and my massage therapist handed me this book a couple months ago. I haven't gotten into it yet because I was finishing another book, but it's called Why We Sleep. And I did read the section on sports and sports performance, and it is really amazing the impact of sleep on your performance. And it really is kind of 8 hours is that kind of magic number. And everybody, some people might be a little bit longer and some people a little bit shorter. But one of the areas it shows is that your chance of injury is just so high if you're getting 6 hours or less of sleep chronically. Mm-hmm. And so your injury rate goes up. And for each hour additional you get, so if you get 7 hours, you get 8 hours, you get 9 hours, the chance of injury decreases radically with how much sleep you're getting. So that's just one area that sleep plays an important role. Of course, it's the time when we really recover and make our body stronger. And there's all kinds of evidence that if you're not getting enough sleep, that your time to physical exhaustion is much shorter, 10 to 30% shorter.
Wow.
Your aerobic output decreases significantly. You have trouble with strength in your muscles and your joints. Your ability to cool is actually worse if you're not getting enough sleep. One of the phrases I hate the most is sleep is overrated. It's definitely not overrated. Sleep is underrated. And it's probably, when you look at it, could be one of the best performance-enhancing drugs that you could have.
And so easy, right?
Yeah, it's easy. Sleep, people, sleep.
I wish it were easy.
Yeah,
I would love to sleep more if I could. And I wonder how much sort of your alertness and your mood, too, because if you're in a good mood, you're a better athlete. And if you're not getting enough sleep, you're crabby and you're not as alert. You might not even realize it because you're so chronically short of sleep.
Yes, and there are tons of studies that show this. There's one motor study where the researcher had people typing out a number sequence. Then he found that the people who did it in the morning and then repeated it at night didn't get very much better at it. But the people who did it at night or later in the day and then slept on it, came back in the morning and repeated it, performed much better. So there's something about the sleep that brought all those motor abilities together too. And and obviously if you're not feeling cranky and tired, then it's easier to do things like that too.
Cool. You heard it here first, folks. You get a good night's sleep and you'll be a better athlete.
Yep, it's true.
Lisa Keller is with Multisport Training of Alaska, and she comes in monthly to help us figure out how to train for endurance events. Thanks, Lisa. We'll see you next month.
Yep. Thank you, Charles.
For our last segment today, we're sticking to the youth theme a little bit with a piece from Philadelphia. This comes from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and was produced by skateboarder Andrew Norton. He takes us for a ride through the surprising history of Love Park and a decades-old battle over public space in Philadelphia and beyond.
A city looks different when you're standing on a board with wheels.
Black wax caked on a ledge or wheel marks on a wall. These are little breadcrumb trails left by my people.
That's our guide today, Andrew Norton. Skateboarders are his people.
And once you start following these trails, they'll lead you to a turf war between the city and the skaters.
As skateboarding has grown, cities began developing ways to push back on the skaters to prevent them from skating in public places. One defense, skate stoppers.
Some kind of a metal peg or raised metal attachment that is either built into a wall or attached to a wall afterwards that creates a discontinuous edge.
Tony Bricali is an architect from Philadelphia. He's fascinated with how skaters interact with the city.
And then it gets more extreme and more ridiculous, where, you know, there are companies that sell things that look like metal seashells and metal crabs that, I guess, for some reason, that's meant to be more aesthetically pleasing. I don't know.
Those aesthetically pleasing skate stoppers are all around the Embarcadero in San Francisco. Tony Bracali wrote an essay called Thanks, Le Corbusier, from the Skateboarders. In it, he contends that Le Corbusier, as the platonic ideal of the modernist architect, with his cool glasses and love of concrete, is the patron saint of skateboarders.
It just turned out that wide open space with nice granite ledges at the edge made really good skateboarding space. And who would have known?
The prime example of modernist landscape architecture that's inadvertently perfect for skateboarding is Philadelphia's Love Park.
The park was designed in part by prominent Philly architect and planner Edmund Bacon.
And in the 80s, when skating took to the streets, the timing was perfect for skaters to claim Love Park as their own.
You know, there was kind of a suburban migration. There was less interest in density. And so places like Love Park were kind of sitting there, not being used.
Philly skate kids would film themselves doing tricks in Love Park. Their videos found their way to the epicenter of skateboarding, California. And Love Park became a destination for skaters.
Even though Love Park was like Mecca, it was never legal to skate there.
I don't think it's legal to skate at Mecca either.
Skaters would get tackled by cops, ticketed by undercovers, or have their boards taken away. And the area was gentrifying. Finally, in 2002, Philly Mayor John Street took the skateboard ban a step further and renovated the park.
They removed all of the granite benches, these great skatable, you know, elements, and they replaced them with Williams and Sonoma-ish looking wood benches that look like they belong in an 1890s kind of park.
They also added ugly wooden pink planter boxes, blocking the skaters from easily skating the granite ledges. Disguised as decoration, the new features were meant to make it harder for skaters to use the ledges or to cruise from one end of the park to the other.
They took away the wide open paved areas and tried to replace them with grassy spaces in between. But the design result was kind of horrible.
People protested the renovations, including Edmund Bacon, the park's chief designer.
Bacon was so against the renovations and crackdown on skaters in his park, he staged his own protest. On October 8, 2002, with the media there, two people propping him up on either side and a blue bicycle helmet on, a white-haired, trench-coat-clad 92-year-old Ed Bacon rode a skateboard in Love Park.
And now I, Edmund Bacon, deliberately skate in my beloved Love Park. Oh. Oh, God! Thank you, thank you, thank you!
The ugly pink planters and William and Sonoma benches still grace Love Park. But so does a plaque memorializing Ed Bacon. And people still skateboard there. And they still get chased by cops.
Love Park isn't the iconic spot it used to be, but skate parks started copying features from its original design.
For Andrew, though, part of the point is to be able to skate in public places, as they are.
And when you land a trick there, it's like a secret victory. You put your own mark on a place.
99% Invisible was produced this week by Andrew Norton, Sam Greenspan, and me, Roman Mars. We're a project of KALW and the American Institute of Architects, San Francisco. Distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. More about this story at 99percentinvisible.org.
And that's all for today's show. We heard about Ultimate Frisbee from my guest John Gregoire and Ann Ohms. And we heard from Caitlin Rodriguez at Trail Tales talking about GRIT, the kids' bike program. Also, we had J.T. Lindholm talking about the Little A Triathlon and Lisa Keller with the training calendar. You can find out more about all of that at our website, outdoorexplorer.org, as well as links to the folks we talked to. Our producer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.